You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey, listeners to the Heritage Voices podcast. This is Chris Webster, founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network. And we're taking a small break during the month of October from releasing new episodes on our current feeds so we can bring you interesting episodes from other feeds on the Archaeology Podcast Network or other podcasts. This time, we're going to bring you one from one of our more popular podcasts, The Dirt Podcast. It's their episode 208 called Finding a Religion with Dr. Candace Lukasik. This episode features an anthropologist and ethnographer, so I figured it would be appropriate for this audience. If you want to listen to more of The Dirt Podcast, look for it wherever you get your podcasts, or go over to archpodnet.com and click on the Dirt logo. All right, on to the show.
And welcome to The Dirt, a podcast about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past. I'm Anna.
And I'm Amber. And a quick shout out before we get into the episode. So thank you to Logan for subscribing at patreon.com/thedirtpodcast and supporting the show.
Yes, thank you, Logan. So our subscribers get a monthly newsletter and, depending on the tier of the subscription, up to 3 monthly-ish bonus episodes of varying levels of absurdity and spiciness. For example, for a recent bonus ep, I watched National Treasure 2, Book of Secrets. It's not good. And then tried to explain the plot to Amber. I'm not sure I succeeded, but I enjoyed trying. And peek behind the curtain, I've also watched 10,000 BC and have so many notes ready to record. So many notes. And we literally couldn't make this show or provide resources like our Pass the Mic grant without our Patreon subscribers. So thanks so much to all of you for your support and your patience. We do our best to be timely with bonus episodes, but 7 episodes a month is a lot for a production team of 2, both of whom have day jobs. All right. How about an episode?
Well, how about a very special guest episode? Good. I'm glad you're on board because you're getting one. This week, we are joined by Dr. Candace Lukasik, an assistant professor of religion and anthropology at Mississippi State University. So her research focuses on the intersections of transnational migration, religion, race, and empire. So there's lots to think about, lots to unpack, and we are very, very excited to learn. So thank you, Candace, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
First things first, how did you first get interested in anthropology? And what has your trajectory been from that first point of interest until now?
Yeah, so I'm going to go a little ways back because anthropology for me is something that I almost feel I stepped into by fate, meaning that, you know, in high school, I was, you know, really politically active and writing op-eds like against the Iraq war and arguing for kind of pro-choice positions at the Supreme Court and all that was happening at that point in time in like the U.S., I guess, political field. So after I graduated high school, I did this program, this Arabic program in Cairo, Cairo, Egypt, through the State Department. I think today it's like known as NYSLI of some sort. Like kind of high school version of the critical language scholarship. You know, from that experience, it really kind of pushed me to think about politics beyond the U.S. I think that for many of us growing up in the U.S., we tend to think of the whole entire world as us. And so from that experience, I really began to kind of focus more broadly on comparative religion and kind of Muslim-Christian relations after my experience in Egypt. And so I was introduced to Middle Eastern Christianity and particularly Coptic Orthodox Christianity during that trip and really became kind of captivated by like Coptic history and present day issues, like whether it be Copts' minority status in Egypt, issues of sectarian violence, anti-Christian violence, or church-state relations. And so while I was this kind of naive political science major during my undergrad, I became more and more interested in how kind of history, culture, and religion impacted upon these political contexts. And I saw them as both like national and transnational in nature. And so Those interests really developed into like many trips to Egypt and like elsewhere in the region since 2007, like expanding my knowledge and network. And it wasn't until I did my MA thesis on Coptic political groups after the 2011 Egyptian Revolution. I did that in the South Asian African Studies Department at Columbia, that I realized how much like I enjoyed thinking with people and attending to kind of everyday intimate their understandings of religion and politics. And it was really about that time that I was introduced, around that time that I was introduced to the work of Saba Mahmoud on Egypt. And I was just captivated. I read an article of hers and I was just captivated by it. And not knowing until later, like she also comes from an interdisciplinary background of political science, like urban planning and architecture. And so it really comes out in how she understood anthropology. And it really kind of directed me towards how I understand anthropology is not just about, cultural life, but also how that cultural life is connected to different scales of power that impacts upon like how people in the everyday see religion and politics, and both for my context, both in the Middle East and now in the US. So,
yeah. So you went from sort of in terms of your degrees, you went from political science to something closer to area studies and then to anthropology.
Yes. Okay. So it was kind of a weird trajectory. I mean, I really thought in my undergrad that I was going to be either going to law school after that and then on to like diplomacy or something, I don't know, at the State Department. And I really just got put off during a number of weird interactions that I had during my undergrad with folks in these Arabic programs that going to be a part
funny
of
how that happens.
Yeah, that happens. I think that there's just a group of expats really of that, those programs that really kind of wanted to go deeper and think about the context they were a part of and not just go the regular diplomacy or consulting route.
Your work largely looks at at the most broad, the anthropology of religion. So what aspects of religion are the most interesting to you?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I was thinking about it for a while. I'm teaching Intro to Religion here for the first time, actually, at Mississippi State University. And I think I'm getting a clearer picture as to what initially drew me to being interested in religion, both academically, but like in, personally too. And I think it's part of who I am as a person too. Like I grew up Catholic in Buffalo, New York, and was really always captivated by the mystical, like the mystery of God and existence. And there was always this kind of feeling that, there was a feeling there that flowed through how I saw the world and has always kind of guided the ways that I study it and empathize, like participate in kind of translations of religious life, I guess you could say. So like the most interesting aspects of religion for me then are really the ways in which people relate to the divine in their everyday lives and take seriously the mystery of that relationship and how it guides human action, interaction, and politics. So while I, tend to focus on kind of different scales of power and how people are impacted by those scales of power, I actually personally and in my writing am interested in how people contend both with those kind of maybe human power relations and how they understand and interpret, divine power in their lives too.
Hmm. Oh, that's well said. Thank you.
I have no follow-up.
Yeah. When so this isn't anything that you need to respond to. I mean, you're welcome to, I find it really compelling to hear you share that, because it sounds so analogous to what I've heard many people, both kind of on this show and outside the show, talk about, almost like a spiritual attachment to the stuff that they study or they research, and sort of the communities that they are trying to understand. And so it is, and that never strikes me as odd. And so to have you talk about sort of like actual spirituality, sort of in the traditional sense, and that sort of being a part of who you are and who you have been, and that sort of bringing you, sort of setting you on the path towards these questions, or putting you in the way of these topics. I find that it feels a little less metaphorical in your sense to how I hear a lot of people talk about it. And I just want to sort of highlight that, because I just find that very like lovely and remarkable. I hope that doesn't sound like condescending in any way.
It comes up, something just kind of on the fly coming up for me too, is that being an anthropologist, even for me, what it allows me to engage with is that sense of kind of giving into who I am and where I've come from in how I'm studying and working with and learning from a particular community. And I don't just mean, you know, in the case of my first big project on Coptic Christians, but, you know, on Coptic Christians in Upper Egypt and a very rural community vis-a-vis in Jersey City, and being a part of those communities, both not just as a researcher, but as somebody learning from them. And so I really think both about my journey in anthropology as one connected to my journey in life. It's not just metaphorical. It's also, you know, I'm learning through the people that I'm, you know, writing about and thinking about for my own personal life too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope that in cases where that is unsaid by others, that it's still true. Because I think that that's a good way to do it. That's a way that I really quite admire. Well, okay. So next real question. So here on the dirt, we spend a lot of our time looking at the more archaeological corners of anthropology. So it truly is a rare pleasure to speak with someone whose focus falls in one of the other three fields. And Candace, normally when we bring somebody on from one of the other three fields, we're just like, how does it happen? Like, how do you do it? But I think we actually are going to be asking you, like, how do you do it? But sort of you talked a bit about your work with Saba Mahmoud, and sort of her interdisciplinary approach to things. But could you tell us a little bit more about your approach to interdisciplinary work? Do you find yourself, I want to know about sort of interdisciplinary versus intradisciplinary, and do you find yourselves drawing from other disciplines more often or more readily than from the other subfields within anthropology? Like, do you find yourselves like thinking much about archaeology or thinking much about sort of the more like biological aspects like linguistic aspects of sort of the communities that you are learning from?
Yeah. You know, I think I've learned throughout the years that it's really just how can I tell this story completely? And I think that from the get-go, that requires doing intradisciplinary work. So yes, you know, I started out in political science, and that kind of gave me a foundation of thinking actually about power and power structures, and was brought into kind of thinking about historical conditions and cultural practices of folks like in and from the Middle East, in area studies work. So kind of going deeper into this I don't even think I had a formulated question at that point in time, but I was following something that I was engaged with and observing in my kind of follow-up trips to Egypt and hanging out with, more and more Coptic friends and family members, et cetera. And that led me, yes, methodologically to anthropology, because I really wanted to attend these kind of, I guess, they would be called like kind of the whispers of life, you know, to like living, breathing people and, you know, being accountable to these people who, you know, have knew what I was doing in terms of my work and research, but trusted me with their stories and with being just like a part of their lives. So being accountable to them. But, you know, now as an anthropologist, like finding themselves in like a department of philosophy and religion, I almost feel that it's very fitting for this moment as I'm also trying to grapple with and explore the intersections of both like theology and critical theory, in finishing up my book project. And all of these kind of different disciplines and methods, et cetera, kind of interweave for me to tell, or to be part of like a broader constellation of, the complete story that I need to tell. And also part of that, especially when thinking about Copts and Coptic Christianity, is that, you know, Coptic archaeology, quite frankly, and thinking about kind of Copts in late antiquity and, you know, Coptologists, while I'm not a Coptologist myself, a lot of these folks are very much engaged in thinking about language, and thinking about, artifacts and sites to excavate and things of that nature, which is not my specialty, but I need to also know what's happening in those fields, because the way in which those folks who are working, you know, maybe from 1,000+ years ago, the conversations that they're having about Copts is actually important to the conversation I'm having about transnational Copts and how Coptic Christians understand themselves in the contemporary world, because those archaeological findings, Coptic language studies is also integral to how they practice as Coptic Christians. So it's not as if, you know, archaeology and, Coptic linguists and those type of folks are completely separated from how Coptic Christians practice and understand their history, et cetera. Actually, they feed into one another. And so it's been super important for me to keep up with what those fields have been doing and what directions they are going in, because it helps me to tell a more complete story about what being Coptic Christian between Egypt and the United States in the 21st century is all about.
In terms of beliefs and cosmology, the farther back you go in time with anything, the less material evidence there is of it. And those things, those ephemeral things like belief, are so hard to pin down. And that's a part of a population's collective experience that we just can't access sometimes. So on to speculation. If you were to speculate what some of the first pieces of shared human beliefs were, what would they be?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been thinking about this for a while too, because this is not just, I think, a question in anthropology or archaeology, but it's also a very theological question, in that, I would say that from the perspective of Orthodox Christian theology, because quite frankly, even though I grew up Catholic, I know Orthodox Christianity much better now, at least for me and how I understand it, helps us to kind of get a piece of that answer. So without kind of delving into research on more recent research on like cognitive connections of religious practices, there's been a number of studies by somebody like Tanya Lerman who think about the kind of what happens when one prays, right? Thinking about cognition and things of that nature, which is not my specialty. I think that there's something mysterious in each of us, right, that kind of draws us toward a divine authority. I wouldn't say that it is cognition necessarily, but it is kind of, again, if we're being speculative here, almost like just kind of like cosmic like energy and particles, I guess you could say, that drives us toward thinking about the divine, whatever that may look like or may have been understood as thousands and thousands of years ago. From an Orthodox like perspective, what was happening thousands and thousands of years ago is still connected to the Orthodox, the Christian story. So even if it didn't have the kind of, biblical through line that we know today, that feeling, that connection was always still there within kind of human beings, and it guided human action. So I guess my speculative answer really is just to say that I think that we've, as humans, have always been connected to mystery in one way or another.
Yeah. And so when you say connection, you're saying sort of connection to the mysterious, like toward, like, I don't know, yearning towards like meaning or mystery. Yeah. Or are you saying connection like among people or both? Is that something?
I think both, maybe not meaning necessarily, but, like, so I don't mean in that like meaning for life, like why are we here, but rather a connection to us, land, environment, each other, that is directed towards something kind of higher, more cosmic, or I would say divine in some way.
Okay, sure. Yeah. And then on the sort of flip side of that, I mean, there is the aspect of mystery, and then also the aspect of trying to understand why certain things are the way they are. And I think probably one of the most, my speculation is that, understanding death is probably one of the places where in the archaeological record, it is where you get some of the first evidence of something, some kind of cohesive system of cosmology or belief or understanding of what happens, because you get deliberate burials. And as soon as you start getting burials with objects like grave goods, you start getting the sense that death was regarded as not necessarily the end of things. Which is always interesting to me. And I don't like, I can't really speculate further. It's just sort of like, there's something that happens there. And even before that, with burial, it could be a practical concern because you don't want to attract, carnivores, but, maybe it's something else. We just don't know.
Yeah.
Well, on the topic of things that Anne and I just don't know, here's the part where I ask about what your flavor of anthropology looks like. So when you do your research, what does it look like sort of in the day to day? Do you have sort of a normal day? How do you go about trying to piece together the story of a community or a cultural group through ethnography and oral history and other and sort of other methods that you pull into your research?
Yeah. So just so that my answer doesn't get too wieldy here. I actually want to talk about a new project that I'm beginning to think about on claims to indigeneity in the Middle East and how migration, transnational connection in what I would describe as imperial ruins in the region kind of frame such claims, and especially among Assyrians between Iraq and the United States. And so, to answer this question based off of my first book project would be so hard because it's been so many years, but being like the first, like my research has been slow going, obviously because of the pandemic. But at base, I'd say that the most important building blocks are making like the main foundations of connection for your like places, interlocutors, et cetera. So thinking in my case, like thinking about what organizations, what specific communities. So I'm thinking of doing this research between Northern Iraq, probably around Erbil and Washington, D.C., partially, and Detroit, Michigan. So it's like really thinking about like what communities am I going to be working with in these three different places, as well as like what individuals are going to be like my main interlocutors, people that I go to really like ask the tough questions that I'm thinking about, and really building that trust and starting to show up for these people even before beginning kind of formal, you know, post IRB like field work, right? Mm-hmm. Of saying, I am interested in these questions. I know members of your community are interested in these questions, and I am going to approach these questions over a period of years with absolute care. And that takes time. So in the pandemic, that has meant for me, and I know that for many people doing field work now for even their dissertations have had to adapt certain things. So for me, that has meant really attending like Zoom meetings of different organizations in the U.S. that were doing those, and being very kind of transparent about conversations they were having, et cetera. And people, you know, seeing my name and knowing who I am and knowing why I'm interested in these questions with them. That has also meant educating myself, right? Like I've been in Egypt for so many years. I will not pretend that I know all there is to know about Syrian history or Iraqi history, even as somebody who knows the Middle East quite well. So it's about kind of following, you know, even in the most kind of modest of ways, following relevant accounts on Instagram and Twitter. There are so many transnational Assyrians that are kind of connecting with one another in these spaces, especially like Instagram, and as well as Twitter, but especially Instagram, because visually it's about kind of piecing together a community that has been dispersed, that has endured genocide. And so that's really been kind of my methodology of, at least in these initial stages, is just getting a few folks that I trust to think through initial questions with, knowing what are the main kind of sites of contention and discussion. And so really every it kind of day to day, it looks like you just kind of building up like one piece of knowledge at a time until you're ready to do that kind of intense field work. That is just, you know, being in the field and being sweaty and losing sleep and trying to find time to write all of those field notes after each and every conversation. That takes a long time to get to that point where you feel comfortable doing that.
We try to give our interview guests sort of opportunities to talk about sort of like what the experience is. And it sounds like this is an experience of long-term work.
Long game.
You just described a lot of work, like sort of years of work before what it sounds like you would call field work.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of like establishing the field before going into it and doing groundwork.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick ad break and then we will be back with more questions.
Hey everyone, Chris Webster from the APN here. We have used a number of solutions for recording our podcast with interesting people from around the world. None have worked better than Zencastr. For the last several years, we've been using Zencastr for high-quality recordings that are easy to do and put little to no stress on the guest. And now, Zencastr has high-quality video and even automatic transcription. So click the link in the show notes or head over to zencastr.com/pricing and use the code HEVO, H-E-V-O, to get 30% off your first 3 months of the Pro Plan. If you're starting a podcast anytime soon, it's totally worth it. Again, click the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months. And they even give a little back to us when you do.
And we're back.
And we are still with Candace Lukasik. And so, Candace, your first book focuses on the ways that Coptic Christianity has been politicized or politically co-opted by American conservatives. And so the sort of gist of the way that the oppression of these communities is being used by those external to it is martyrdom. So is that how Coptic Christians see their own collective past? Is it not? And how does the whole process of a political party latching on to another group's experience and co-opting it for political reasons, how does that happen?
Here's the thing. I don't think there's like an easy answer to this question without, you know, attending to moments where Copts, I guess, respond to and engage like this politicization. Mm-hmm. And meaning that answering this question would be very different in if I answered it with a vignette, for example, like from a conference in Washington, D.C. on Christian persecution, whereby both like Coptic Christians as well as Nigerian Christians and a number of other Christians in, for the most part, Muslim majority contexts have been co-opted and used for certain political ends. But I think I want to answer this question like from a different like lens, and that
sure,
there are ways that even in Egypt, the politicization of Coptic martyrdom by American conservatives also kind of lends legitimacy and power to Copts as being part of a global Christian community, like one in which they weren't always considered to be a part, whether during the kind of periods of colonization and missionization, whereby Copts were not understood to be Christians. And so in that context, even in Egypt, kind of the way that American conservatives have focused on Coptic martyrdom, so maybe even in the case of the 21 martyrs of Libya in February of 2015, where 20 Copts and one Ghanaian man were beheaded on the shores of Libya for refusing to renounce their faith. And that particular episode has been taken up by Christians globally. And Christians inside of Egypt, whether they're family members of those that were martyred or not, have seen that that recognition in a positive light. Hmm. But aside from that, I will say, let me just talk a little bit about a story from the U.S. context, because I think that this is where we find things to be a little bit interesting, where in the U.S., like, responses of Copts to this politicization like really varies according to generation. So, I mentioned, because I think it's such an interesting scene, I mentioned the scene in my article that kind of introduces my ideas in my book from American anthropologists from last year, where a Coptic woman I interacted with in New Jersey had a hard time believing Muslims would hire Christians to work at food carts in Manhattan. And she believed that the Muslim Brotherhood was trying to take over America. So it was a conversation both about Coptic employment and Muslim employers, and how all those Muslim employers that worked at food carts were a part of a Muslim Brotherhood conspiracy. So this woman who I've called Justina was a second generation Copt, born and raised in New Jersey, as I mentioned, but her parents are still very connected to Egyptian political context. So through like TV, like they have these, I mean, you can order it even if you're outside of New York, New Jersey, you can have like this attachment to your TV and like watch Egyptian television without ever watching like American TV. So it's kind of cool. But I don't know if, I don't know if I would want solely that on my TV, but so whether like through TV, like social media, like communications on Viber, WhatsApp, et cetera. So in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood's rise to power after 2011, the revolution in 2011 there, was, a major issue for many religious minorities, but I mean, including and especially Coptic Christians. And that's because like historically some of those political discourses of the organization and other Islamist organizations led to increased violence against Copts. And so those very real contexts, like in Egypt, obviously followed Coptic migrants to the U.S. and intermixed with far right and like not so far right rhetoric on the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist organizations, kind of, as I talk about in my book, infused with this like Cold War battle for the future of Western civilization and the threat of Islam to Western civilization. And so 9/11 and more recently the rise of ISIS kind of continued this rhetoric. And under Trump, like such discourses obviously around Islam made their way into the halls of Congress. And that's actually nothing new, but somebody like Ted Cruz and other members of Congress have tried to label the Muslim Brotherhood a global threat and a, you know, a terrorist organization. And so you can kind of see how these different contexts might come together in the U.S. So, you know, those broader geopolitical contexts of U.S. empire and like their international reach of the far right, which, you know, Ted Cruz could be said to be a part of in various ways, intersect with of the national and local Egyptian ones that Justina and her family have engaged with. And that's where that particular perspective of Justina kind of comes about. So like hearing about those Egyptian contexts from her parents and following Egyptian news and thinking about the Muslim Brotherhood through an Egyptian context contributes to her understanding of like who they are in U.S. society. And so like taking into account those like homeland contexts in, you know, like migrant translations, you could say, and kind of intergenerational translations, like shouldn't be taken for granted, really. And so that's kind of where those different scales come together, where that that kind of conservative politicization interacts with kind of community engagement with it.
Can I ask a 101 question?
Yes. Yes.
What are the ways, the like primary ways that Coptic Christianity differs from, say, Catholicism or?
How is Coptic Christianity different? How is Coptic Orthodoxy different? I will say that theologically, you know, quite different. Well, let me take a step back and say, obviously, you know, Protestants and Catholics theologically are quite different. Right. One community, and Orthodox are also a part of this argument too, is, you know, more hierarchical in nature, more dependent upon, you know, thinking about authority and practice, and the importance of, you know, sacraments, like being more specific. And the other Protestants, who vary, there's so many sects of Protestantism, for the most part, you know, very much are focused less on, you know, ritual practice, let's you could say, I guess, and very much about being very Bible-based. Again, not to say that Catholicism isn't Bible-based, but it is to say that the separation between these two communities is really dependent upon the authority of the church and sacramental life. So Catholics and Orthodox both share that. Well, it makes kind of Coptic Orthodoxy very different, even from like Eastern Orthodoxy, is that Protestants, Catholics, and Eastern Orthodox all share the same theology around the nature of Christ. So thinking about Jesus Christ's human and divine natures. And in the Council of Chalcedon in 451 AD, essentially, there was an argument over the nature of Christ and what are today understood to be Coptic Orthodox Christians from that time period until today have been split off from the rest of Christendom because they took on the church took on a different position from what was accepted at that council. And so because of that, I mean, that theological difference actually infused itself like into colonial difference too. So when Egypt was colonized by the French and the British, and more or less formally colonized in some ways by other European countries, the way in which they talked about Copts was very much through this heretical lens, right? And so it really only becomes over the past 30 years that Coptic Orthodox Christians, because of this you know, contention with Muslims and anti-Christian violence in Egypt have been more accepted as actual Christians. And so this is where the moment of conservative politicization of Coptic martyrdom becomes so unique and interesting, because they're almost accepted as equals on the plane of kind of global Christendom.
Have you seen or read or sort of inferred any sense of like reconciliation or revisionism on the part of these political or politico-religious bodies here in the U.S. Who are opening arms to Coptic Christian communities?
Has there been any official, theological statements to that end? No, but there are interesting ways in which we can see how Copts have been accepted on a different plane of Christian intelligibility, from today in comparison to even 30 years ago. So like, even beyond the example of the politicization of Coptic martyrdom in Washington, D.C., there are kind of transnational initiatives of evangelical ecumenism, whereby they have brought in Coptic Orthodox to be interlocutors. So, for example, the Coptic Bishop Angelos of London, he co-chairs an initiative called the Lusane Orthodox Evangelical Initiative, which basically is kind of centered on Protestant or evangelical and Orthodox, and in this case, Coptic Orthodox understanding and kind of community building through different projects across the global South, interfaith projects across the global South. And so that is very unique. Not only that, but Bishop Angelos is also the head of the Bible Society in the UK. Also fascinating, just because the Bible Society, typically a Protestant organization, was a part of missionary and colonial efforts in Egypt.
That is exactly what I thought something with that name would have.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just sort of calling it that, it sort of it is an illustrative name.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, the last point would be after the beheading of the 21 in Libya in February of 2015, Pope Francis came out and said, you know, that these are martyrs, these are Christian martyrs, like that they traversed church and denomination and sect and all of that. And that there is, and he termed it an ecumenism of blood, that these martyrs were transvalued even beyond what, you know, sect they were or whatever. They were martyrs for all of us. And that is, I mean, incredibly fascinating. I mean, he had to backtrack a little bit because there are some Catholic traditionalists that would say, but no, they're still not, they're not our saints. They're not our martyrs. Mm. But for the Pope of, you know, the Catholic Church to come out and say that is quite significant. So Copts are really only recognized as being part of global Christendom when they're kind of dead or bloody.
Ecumenism is sort of unity among Christian denominations. And is it sort of like, I'm going off of like Sunday school. So this is.
Yeah. And I'm going off of Hebrew school, which is even less helpful here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in layman's terms, it would be how I just personally understand it, because even as like a non-theologian, I sometimes wonder what it actually means. But ecumenism is, from my understanding, is really about how can we come together in peace. And so not just like as Christians, but ecumenism is, I mean, I guess like for listeners out there, it would be, you know, akin to really thinking about interfaith, the dialogue, right? But ecumenism in the Christian sense also means, you're right, like, how do we come together as a unified Christianity? I mean, not to say that all theological and like church related issues go away, but it's like the goal.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Candace, what are some insights from your research, like from either from your new project or for your sort of your first book? This is, it's like wild to hear you say it, like first book, new book. But what are some insights that you've gained from your time in the field and sort of on your journey that you most want people to understand?
Yeah, what big question there. I think at base, I am still very fascinated about what happens to religion and migration. And so, like, I think first off, I would want to have folks understand that, like, migration is not just about the destination. It's not just about, you know, questions of assimilation or enculturation or any of those sociological terms, but, you know, or even the process of migrating, of like literally following people as they're moving between a homeland and a diaspora. So kind of in the physical sense. Rather, I think it's important to like attend to those homeland contexts, like why migrants want to and end up leaving. That matters enormously. And it matters because those contexts impact upon diaspora politics. So for me, you know, I hope that I can do this justice in my second project, understanding where migrants, where folks are coming from, those contexts is important to understanding how they translate things that are happening in their everyday lives here. And even folks in like the second or third generations, how they interpret what Egypt is or what Iraq is or any of those other places is important to how they understand themselves in the US and elsewhere. So that's kind of first and foremost as kind of a methodological point, I guess, on migration. But the second, and finally, just something like very basic, is that Middle Eastern Christians or minority communities in the Middle East are more than discourses of violence and persecution. Mm-hmm. They are more than historical objects of observation. So even thinking about archaeologists here, some of them that engage in Coptology in that way. They are in Assyriology. They are citizens. They're migrants with power to reshape broader narratives of, you know, citizenship, human rights, and for me, especially thinking about, you know, class conditions in places like Egypt, as well as racial justice, political organizing, and popular culture in the U.S. That's, you know, what I really, really want people to walk away from, especially with my first book.
Since we now know that doing research in the way that you do takes a lot of planning and forethought and laying the groundwork, what's a good starting place for people interested in research addressing religion of any kind and other aspects of culture in extant communities? So like in that process of laying groundwork and thinking about a project focusing on a community, where do you even start?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say very briefly that it's really about being a part of those communities. And I don't mean like as a convert. I mean, that happens sometimes, but not as a convert, but as someone invested in their well-being and their futures. So not simply as an analyst, not simply as somebody collecting like information for, you know, a given project, but also as an ally, that you have a responsibility to the people that are opening up their homes and hearts and pain and injury to be discussed. And so in my opinion, like we should not be reproducing kind of colonial forms of knowledge of like extraction for, you know, in a very crass way, just like for professional gain, that these are people that have the context that we study is sometimes, you know, life or death.
Right. They're not people. Just assets.
Exactly. And so that's where I would actually, that's where I would start, is kind of grounding yourself in that ethos.
Is this something that, like, is there sort of like a methodological
handbook?
Yeah. Or like doing like sort of like ethical.
I feel like, and there should be,
if there's, yeah. Is that, or is it something that you have, is it something that you learned, just through reading, examples of unethical work?
Yeah.
And like, is it sort of negatively constructed? Like, is it sort of like, I don't want to do that,
yeah,
or like, I don't want this outcome. How can I set this up? And was this something that is sort of codified somewhere, or is it completely uncodifiable?
To be honest, I don't know if I have any specific books on ethics, but rather for me though, it was something that was cultivated in being a student of Saba Mahmood, as well as Charles Hirschkin. And the reason I say that is not just because I learned how to read from them, but because of the attention on power and conditions and even class dynamics, attending to how these things all come together to produce different ways of seeing the world in the communities that we work with, become kind of allies to, mm-hmm, was key to me kind of developing a certain ethical base in how I understand my work. And even how the argument in my first book has developed, right? In really thinking about how migration of Copts to the United States, or migration of actually other communities, minority communities from the Middle East to the United States, didn't just happen randomly, right? That there are certain kind of social forces that have directed folks into that migratory path. And so with that as my kind of lighthouse of attending to what are the structural conditions by which, these people make choices, mm-hmm, some of them very difficult, is really what has kind of guided me in thinking about questions associated with my work, and being also generous with people that I have worked with in the field that are not, I don't see them as really good friends. Let's just say, like, I see them as having very bad opinions and rather dangerous opinions, political opinions and otherwise, without kind of attending to how they got to the place that they got to. I can't have any source of humility or understanding, mm, without kind of attending to these broader conditions. I know that probably is too broad of an answer, but
no, it's hard just, to articulate. Yeah, I wanted to give people some things to think about in terms of, because this is so far removed from the way that I think about anthropology, mm-hmm, just because of my own interests and my own training. And so I'm trying to think from the perspective of someone listening who is really interested in the idea of doing this sort of broader ethnographic research, but I don't know how to guide them. So,
like, everything that you're saying, Candace, is really insightful and I think valuable for someone who only thinks about sort of deep history.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's not valuable to me. Sorry, that was not my point
but
at all.
I'm saying that this is no. I'm trying to imply that you did say that, but I think that it's really valuable of just try, because what we do here is we try to, as best we can, remind ourselves and our listeners, and our, those with whom we're in conversation, that the past is full of people with interiority, yeah, and it's full of communities and
lived experiences
and sort of, yeah, emotion and experience of circumstance. And so, some of what you're talking about in your work, Candace, is a bit divergent from similar work, perhaps contemporary work and past work, in terms of not not necessarily seeing the complete humanity of its human subjects that it's trying to study. I find your approach and your work like very like powerful and compelling and sort of something to look to as sort of an example of a very like good, responsible,
yeah, good scholarship.
Attentive scholarship. And I think that it's something that if we're going to be reading across specialties and we're going to be reading across disciplines, I think that this is something that that folks who think only in non-extant communities, whether or not there's a descendant community or not, that it doesn't really factor in. I think that this is something really valuable. And also, we had an episode earlier this year on the Neo-Assyrians. Mm-hmm. This was sort of me talking about kind of the archaeological record. And then we had a bit of a coda at the end to sort of remind people that that Assyrians exist and sort of that there is this sort of continuity and a lot of the attention that is paid to sort of Mesopotamian kingdoms and sort of the Assyrian imperial state really like highlights the brutality of it. Mm-hmm. And sort of the military prowess.
Some people are so into it.
People who, who like kind of fetishize that violence, yeah. And then you have the contemporary Assyrian community and Assyrian diasporas that are sort of only understood, as you said, as sort of historical objects or narratives of violence.
We're not not even alive. Like that's
exactly.
One of the fascinating aspects about, I think archaeology will actually factor more into my second book than even the first one, because really Assyrians have solely been understood through these ancient contexts, right? So even the term, even communities that say we are Assyrian, there are many of these, you know, archaeologists and I don't think that, I don't know, you can correct me. I don't know if there's Assyriologists anymore, but Assyriologists.
All right.
Well, good to know. Well, so these are the folks that I'm going to have to be reading because modern day Assyrians really have major issues with how they frame their identity and how they kind of denigrate them and say that they don't exist. And they're just trying to kind of invent a new identity for themselves. Yeah. These have really serious consequences for, indigenous claims in places like Northern Iraq, like where, maintaining their presence and saying that we are Assyrian and speaking Assyrian is vital to their survival.
We're going to take one more break and then we're going to get back to the hardest questions that we ask every guest. Mm-hmm. And so I'll give you just a few seconds more to think of your answers, Candace. And we'll be right back. We are back. And so our penultimate question for you is what's the best thing about anthropology? Obviously, this is your opinion, but...
Yeah, I think that I've gotten more militant in the past few years about anthropology. And, even as somebody in, a department of philosophy and religion, I think that militancy will continue to grow in the sense that I really love anthropology because, yes, it has its positives and negatives in terms of who becomes anthropologists and what they study and then publish on.
Who is it for?
I don't know. I was just thinking about certain Twitter threads around this topic. But no, what's the best thing about anthropology for me is that, again, it comes to a question of methodology. Like, why am I an anthropologist and not, for example, a sociologist or a political scientist or whatever? And it's really because I think that we attend to everyday life and not just the retelling of stories. So obviously other fields, religious studies, sociology, et cetera, even political science, has taken on the methodologies of anthropology, or have really reduced it to ethnography and field work. And that's not exactly what, you know, what anthropology is or what its complexities are. It's not just the retelling of stories, but it's really, in my mind, interweaving them in like creative and sometimes poetic ways that really kind of offer an opening to not only see the world differently, but offer a different world of like pathways forward. So again, it's not just kind of being a stenographer of like recording what people do and then telling other, you know, academics and other folks what people do, but it's about interweaving those stories within a broader one in a very artistic way that I think that anthropologists and as well as archaeologists, I would say, were storytellers and were sculptors in many ways. And so that's what I think the best thing about anthropology is that we're allowed to, for the most part, kind of think of a world beyond the one that we have here.
Brilliant answer.
Yeah.
I loved it. This is the really hard one. I mean, we've been told it's the really hard one. So if you could be a fly on the wall for any moment in either human history or prehistory, or for any moment in the history of anthropology as the discipline developed, what would you most want to see?
Yeah, this is a hard one, and I'm not trying to cop out here, but I think that, again, like the way that I answer these questions, the way I even write is about, okay, what I've experienced. And I worked in a village in Upper Egypt, and that has a lot of these really old villas from like the 1800s, early 1900s, and they're just dilapidated and pretty much destroyed. And I always just like imagine, I wish that I was in it, like I could transport myself to like the moment that they were alive. And I think for me, even more so, walking through the streets of Cairo, because that city is so, I mean, really formed who I am as an adult, quite frankly, and my experiences there, I kind of just like often wonder what things were like, you know, on the street that I'm walking in, like 100, 200, 500 plus years ago. And even before then, even walking in Alexandria, I'm like, where are all of these, you know, famous people? Where would they have been? You know,
I thought you were going to say, where's the library?
Yeah. Where's the library? Oh my gosh. Yes. Like that's also one of those things. One of the, sometimes I wish I was an archaeologist only because I would love to like just be in the thick of those excavations, you know, and to be uncovering things and just to like think about what was here when these, you know, items were placed here, or what life was like, it's about kind of walking through these different neighborhoods and walking into a space that is just like pregnant with so many memories. And so I don't know if it's kind of a specific time, but there's so many times I would love to just be transported to in a place like Cairo, quite frankly, to see what all of the events, all of the things, all of the people, all of those memories, all of those events that made Cairo what it is today. And so, yeah, that would be my answer.
Well, in this scenario, you're a time traveling fly, so you can go see whatever you want.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that. I watched this really horrible TV show on HBO called The Time Traveler's Wife, and it's really bad. But
book's pretty good.
The book is pretty good. Okay, yeah. The show is not, but I really wish I was that dude, though. I would love time travel.
You would like to be the titular time traveler?
Yes.
Your answer was, you know, beautifully put, and reminds me of very timely. So it's going to date this episode a bit. I don't know if you're familiar with the cartoonist and sort of graphic novelist Dina Muhammad.
Yes. Saw her cartoon today on Twitter. Yeah. Today, I was like, yes, that's what my answer is. That's exactly.
So for all of us who didn't see that tweet today, it's a really wonderful comic, and you know, we'll
post
retweet it when this episode comes out, it's just about sort of kind of the thickness of history in these spaces, and sort of the thickness of and sort of the depth of kind of the history and emotion and experience and sort of joy and pain that you sort of walk through when you're in spaces like that. And so, yeah, that's really, really wonderful.
I do want to say that it traverses though this loving of like old places and things, I carry with me everywhere. I mean, I'm even looking at old kind of houses in the Mississippi, like where I am in Mississippi, you know, and I want something from like the late 19th, early 20th century, hopefully with a good history. That being said, I love that kind of old style because I just feel that there's life there, you know? And so I experienced that a lot in Cairo, that kind of overwhelming feeling of history.
This sort of, that's a, you know, you would, if you were to sort of reincarnate yourself as an archaeologist, you'd be a great phenomenologist of sort of going in and fully, you know, experiencing the landscape.
Yes. Well, Candace, thank you so much for talking with us. I need to sit. My brain is really full and I need to sit, but in the best way. And I'm looking forward to just kind of chewing over this over the next few days. If folks want to find you and your work online, where should they go?
You know, they can go to my website. It's CandaceLukasik.com. They can also go to our department website at Mississippi State University, the Department of Philosophy and Religion. And so those would be the main two places to find me. And I'm really open to receiving any correspondence from folks that have any questions about my work or any of the thoughts that I shared with you both here today. I love talking to people, so feel free to shoot me an email.
Yeah, well, thank you for listening, everyone. We will be in your ears again next week with new content, which you can find where you found this, anywhere you get your podcast. So Spotify, Audible, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever, anywhere you like. It's there.
Until then, you can find all our back episodes at thedirtpod.com, where you can also find our show notes, where we will have links to Candace's website and other things that were mentioned in this episode. We've got resources for educators, info about sponsoring episodes, the link to our Patreon, our merch store, and more. And you can also find us on social media. On Facebook, you can find us at The Dirt Podcast. On Twitter, we're at Dirt Podcast. And on Instagram, we're at The Dirt Pod. Thank you again, Candace. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We love you. Goodbye.
Bye.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.